Bank, who's going to speak to us about operationalizing racial justice. Dr. Maybank is an activist, a preventive medicine and public health physician, and a proud Brooklynite. Dr. Maybank, MD, MPH, is the Chief Health Equity Officer and a Senior Vice President for the American Medical Association, where she focuses on embedding health equity across all the work of the AMA and leading the Center for Health Equity.
Who's going to speak to us about operationalizing racial justice? Dr. Maybank is an activist.
Was instrumental in infusing equity at neighborhood level and advancing the department's place-based approach to addressing health inequities. She was also the founding director of the Office of Minority Health in the Suffolk County Department of Health Services. Dr. Maybank has taught medical and public health students on topics related to health inequities, public health leadership and management, physician advocacy, and community organizing in health. Dr. Maybank is a pediatrician and preventive medicine and public health physician. Dr. Maybank.
Thank you. I appreciate it and wonderful to be on the panel. So I'm just going to share my screen quickly so I can pull up my slides and then we can get started here. All right. Wonderful. And I'll just make a presentation mode and we should be good to go. All right. Everyone can see that?
Yes. Yes, I can see that.
All right. Great. So I'm going to speak about some of the work that we're doing the health department. And some of it is building upon my work at the health department, but really, what are we doing post kind of a commitment to health equity at the AMA? I start off always with a land and labor acknowledgement, and that we acknowledge, that we are all living off of the stolen ancestral lands of Indigenous peoples. And we acknowledge the extraction of brilliance, energy, and life for labor forced upon people of African descent, but all groups still remain resilient and have strength. And I'm just very conscious of this, even personally, that I stand on the shoulders of many people who have come before me to sacrifice oftentimes their lives, but still continue to thrive for this equity and justice work. And I think that's an important part of when we do operationalize racial justice, we have to center the voices and the ideas and the people who have been historically most marginalized in this country. And just, a few grounding terms, because this becomes, I think it's somewhat of a pet peeve of mine probably, but I think really important in terms of just clarity of language, that, my role in the work is beyond diversity and inclusion. It's inclusive of diversity and inclusion. And we know diversity is absolutely critical in having identities being represented in multiple ways. And we also know belonging is very essential for any of us in any place and space that we occupy. However, what we're really driving and striving to get towards is really this piece around equity. And equity brings more so in the context of power and the redistribution oftentimes of power. And that can be in the form of finances, decision-making, people. But we have to get to that root cause or the fundamental part of getting towards equity and justice ultimately as well. And so this here is, a simple depiction of what justice is. However, it's very clear that in this photo, and a lot of the millennials used to tell me that, and I only keep it in just to really demonstrate how oftentimes there are so many narratives with even the visuals that we have that we don't even see something that may be a problem or perpetuating a narrative. So this is kind of, these folks seem pretty male appearing, and how inclusive really is this diagram with all its good intention to describe these distinctions between equality, equity, and justice, and equality, talking more about the sameness, equity, saying again that we need to redistribute the resources so that we can have the same opportunities or achieve the same kind of outcome. And justice is really about removing the structures and the barriers that exist. And so during this time of COVID, I think what really became very apparent, and for me in doing equity work, it's this tremendous opportunity around narrative and what's being said as it relates to narrative. But the initial narrative was around, Black, Latinx, and Native Americans having and dying more from underlying conditions. But the underlying conditions really kind of, you know, the conversation was left at that. And there was lots of advocacy from many equity leaders and many activists to say that is not a sufficient enough explanation. We have to really look at these really root structural drivers of inequities and social drivers of inequities and start thinking about, you know, more actively framing root cause a lot differently. And so one of them that elevated, you know, was that, you know, it wasn't necessarily race that was the risk factor, which we all know is a social construct at this point, but it's the system and the power system and of racism that really historically and at this present day has been impacting people's lives. And so, you know, there's been more and more work around narrative power and just understanding how there are narratives that are within our context of our communities and our society, dominant and sometimes you may say malignant narratives that are often silent or just not elevated or hidden purposefully sometimes. And really the effect of some of these dominant and malignant narratives is really obscuring power and who's responsible. And so I think our challenge in doing this equity work, when I think about operationalizing in our opportunity, not only our challenges, how do we disrupt and challenge the typical narrative that we know undermine health equity? And here are some of them. Dr. Kamara Jones speaks a lot to these narratives, and she refers to them as a little bit differently, but still aligned in the same way. But our kind of context within this country is this whole belief around individualism, and that, you know, it's about either right or wrong lifestyle changes, not really looking at the drivers of which people live in, or it's about picking yourself up by your bootstraps, a complete myth, because we know there are people who work extremely hard and they're still not going to have the same wealth as others in this country, no matter how hard they work. And then the myth around the hierarchy of human value based on skin color, with white being on top. So these are some of the narratives, and there's more and more narrative work being done. Another important frame for us, so it's interesting because I've been in the public health space for most of my career. It's only really in the last 2 years that I've been more so really deeply rooted now in the healthcare space. And I better appreciate even more the divide between public health and healthcare and how that really needs to move forward in a different direction. But part of that, you know, now that I'm engaging more so with physicians, is recognizing that there are tremendous gaps in knowledge and understanding about these larger drivers that are more upstream in terms of what produces bad health outcomes. So what happens on the right-hand side? Most clinical care and healthcare and education has really been on the right side of this diagram. And so now, you know, it's providing lots of education again to understand the structural and social drivers of health, understanding the institutional power, and then the lenses, the root causes and the systems of power and oppression that are listed on the left-hand side. That really fundamentally drive the inequities in this country. Excuse me. Here's another definition that, again, I give credit to Kamara Jones because she's done a lot, and I want to make sure she gets her credit. But you know, these system, structure, opportunity, assigned value unfairly disadvantage some and unfairly advantage others. And you can interchange, you know, with any form of the isms in order to just understand what is happening within these systems. And then ultimately they sap the whole society through a waste of human resources. And many of us know are very clear that this has impacts on our individual and collective health through varying different mechanisms, and that it's not just at a very static one point in time or even over one individual's life course, but this gets passed down. The impacts of racism and sexism and classism actually translate and transcend across generations and all set up individuals and communities for early death. And these inequities, you know, are structured in our policies and institutions are reflected in our data. I know Dr. Wolf will probably talk a little bit more about this in his conversation, but, you know, this is some of the data from this year around the impacts. Clearly, you know, COVID has had tremendous impact in terms of life expectancy on this country, but we see these great gaps again as it relates to looking at the differences between race and ethnicity. And so COVID really only serves for these gaps to get greater. But it's imperative that we focus on the greatest gaps, oftentimes, not to the exclusion of focusing on health and prioritizing other communities. But we all have a sense of, for the most part, many of us, that if we focused on the greatest gaps, it would actually improve the context of health for everyone in this country. This is a paper that was done by Dr. Bassett, who I would say is my mentor and is now at the FXB Center at Harvard. She was a commissioner when I was starting the Center for Health Equity. And really put forward, you know, again, the structural racism being a really strong driver for the inequities that exist within this country. And then this is a new book. I think it's absolutely excellent, Inflamed: Deep Medicine and the Anatomy of Injustice. I've been using this this visual for a while, but the book was just published very recently, and I've had the privilege, it will be published a little later this month. I had the privilege to write a review of this book, but really speaking not just to the American context, but also kind of really connecting the dots globally, but also, again, finding those pathways or identifying and naming those pathways of systems of oppression that are large, deep, historical to present day trauma that exists and elevates within communities. And the inflammation that's the outcome of that. And so our roles now, and when you have this kind of foundation, and this is work that, you know, or context that, you know, we're teaching and engaging our own staff around, but also physicians around, when we start to understand that, then I think our roles are really along naming and calling out, you know, white supremacy, racism, and other forms of systems of oppression, making them visible beyond just the descriptive inequities and data that oftentimes we see, especially in medical journals, but really understanding how these systems operate to cause harm. And what does it really mean to build a system of care? And I think is a really critical question for us. And I don't mean just healthcare. I'm talking about public health as well. Like what does care really look like as it relates to the work that we're doing and the outcomes we're really driving towards, because it's clear that that's not how it's showing up. And so many folks have made many declarative statements over the last year, specifically, especially around anti-racism, but equity overall, and it's not just in health and the health spaces, but corporate America, all types of folks. And the question is then, how do you move beyond, you know, the declaration and move more towards practice? And then also, how do we better interrogate? Like, how do we use, you know, our activism, you know, spaces better? And I get, for many people, you know, it's not easy at the institutional level to call out institutions, especially if you're in the institution themselves, because there's risk, there's perceived and there's real risk for that. My suggestion always is to operate and work in solidarity with others and be strategic so that we can, again, you know, peel a shield away from all these injustices that are existing. And so I bring up this because, you know, most people are pretty familiar with an incident that happened with our JAMA Medical Journal earlier this year. And, you know, it was an opportunity to kind of understand what is happening at the medical journals. And so in partnership with Nancy Krieger and Rhea Boyd and Fernando de Mayo, who's on my team, did some analysis around, you know, how often is the word racism used and how often are empirical studies done? And the number is really tremendously small. And so, you know, what we do see now is we definitely see journals, and this is a form of activism, right? And we see journals stepping up and starting to do differently, which is really important to this work. So now, you know, at AMA, you know, it's very clear to folks. So we have a management team of 1,100 folks, and then we have a staff of 1,100, and then we have a membership of 270,000 physicians. And so it's the physicians who really pass the membership pass policy. It's the staff's role to really execute on that policy and put the work in motion. And so it's very clear to all staff, and the CEO has made this clear, is that equity is a cross-enterprise accelerator. It is rooted, the Center for Health Equity is rooted in our policy as AMA. And this is the direction that we're going. It has to be embedded into all the work that we're doing. And it's the question of helping people figure out the how to do that, right? So we have kind of the why, and then now it's like the how. And so we released a strategic plan back in, sorry about that. If you can hear any background noise, I apologize. We released a strategic plan back in May, and it has five strategic approaches: embedding equity, building alliance and sharing power, ensuring equity and innovation, pushing upstream to address all determinants of health, and then fostering pathways for truth, reconciliation, and healing for our AMA past. And when you do this work internally, you know, it's important to have our theories of change. And on the left-hand side, just writing the injustices of our past, I talked about challenging the malignant and dominant narratives that we know are pervasive in health, centering the voices and ideas of those who are most marginalized, adopting an anti-racist approach and a race and approach. We lead with race and racism because it's one, the hardest thing oftentimes for people to talk about. That's the one they want to avoid and talk about all the other isms. And we know that our data within this country actually shows some of the greatest gaps along race and ethnicity. So it's not to the exclusion of other identities or other forms of oppression. It's just saying we are going to talk about race and racism and understand its fundamental being a fundamental driver of why inequities exist in this country. Embracing public health frameworks, and then the inside-outside strategy. So just a little bit about the embedding. Again, you can't, I love this quote by Alice Walker, that we'll be really misled if we think we can change society without changing ourselves. And this work is, this is the hard part of the work, is because oftentimes as institutional leaders, folks want to do something that's like in partnership, you know, so we'll name, they'll want to do something in partnership with others, but not really focus kind of as leaders, the internal reflection and work that we have to do in order to change our own heart sets and mindsets in order to push this work forward. It has to, it's institutional, clearly system level work, but we are all individuals within that system as well. And we're leaders who show up within that system. So we have to be willing to do the work too. There are frameworks out there. So we're building upon a framework that we used when I was at the New York City Department of Health. This is from GARE, the Government Alliance for Racial Equity, which is very much connected to Race Forward, which is one of the largest racial justice organizations in this country. But it's a easy enough kind of framework of saying normalize. So within your institution, you know, you have to normalize spaces. You have to build a shared analysis. Like everything that I did in the first part of this presentation is a point of education. Everyone has to come with the same analysis so we can talk about these issues. And really, again, you know, interrogate, hold accountability to our institution. So this is a lot of the training work from many different levels that's important. But we all know training is never sufficient enough, but you do need to do it. Organizing. So this institution, we understand the power oftentimes of organizing outside of our institutions to drive change and for advocacy. The same thing is really important internal to the institution as well. In order to drive change, we have to get everyone kind of on board as much as we can to move in solidarity to really push for change faster. And then operationalizing is like, what are the tools that you need to have in front of you to really change your mental models? And that can be, you know, using the data and metrics, and you have to use data and metrics, but you could quantitative, qualitative data, but all the tools. And then wrapped around this is a trauma-informed and healing supports and lenses, because this work is hard work. And oftentimes you don't want to re-traumatize people, and there's a potential it's going to happen because folks aren't used to these conversations. And we have to create some sense of psychological safety in moving forward to do this work. And so we at the AMA collectively, this is our vision statement, you know, for employees. We have a very, you know, inclusive process to engaging employees in many different levels of work groups that we have. We have, you know, a health equity work group that represents all of our business units. We have cross-enterprise work groups. You know, we have our employee resource groups that our CEO is engaged a lot with. So there's, you know, there's lots of inclusivity in this process. And that's really different for many institutions as well, right? Most decisions are very top-down. They're not as inclusive, and it takes time. And it takes patience in order to do work in that way. Early on, there was definite training around, and I mentioned the CEO. I think this was really critical, honestly, in helping support a lot of support from our board of trustees and our senior leaders, because they did go through this training. It's a 2-day training. And this was back in October, but they were able to, it's almost once you kind of see something, you can't really turn away from it. So they were able to be very supportive of a plan that we put forward. Our accountability infrastructure, I mentioned some about that, and that we have different groups that are helping support doing this work. And it's critical that, you know, their performance metrics also are holding them accountable as employees to doing this work as well. And then important is this racial equity toolkit. So for every program or policy or anything that's developed, what are some critical questions that you ask yourself every single time you develop something new or you revise something? These are some guides and some training that we've been doing with our teams to help support them really challenge how we're ensuring that our efforts are really not exacerbating equity or denying care. We're doing lots to build alliances and share power with organizations and partnering with different folks in different types of ways that oftentimes we have the AMA have excluded. Many folks know the AMA excluded Black physicians for over 100 years. And so we're finding different types of partnerships to engage with our goals of that we want to meet. And this is just one of them, release the pressure. It's not even, when this campaign goes out, it doesn't even have AMA branding on it, because we don't want AMA branding on it in the sense of we want to share that power with the NMA, the National Medical Association, the Association of Black Cardiologists. We're all equal contributors in terms of decision-making around the campaign. Pushing upstream is addressing all drivers of health and the root causes of those inequities. We're working to really support physicians, as I mentioned at the top of this, so they understand public health, the drivers, and then start to work with health systems and equip them to work with their health systems to improve many aspects of the healthcare system. And this is another just demonstration of moving upstream. Healthcare is more so to the left-hand side. It's still not fully there, but about, you know, you hear lots about social needs, and sometimes that word is used a little bit wrong, but the social needs versus social determinants of health. There are growing numbers of healthcare institutions that are now really understanding that they can have investments, you know, at a local level and help support and work in partnership with community-driven processes to improve community health and advocate for social drivers of health inequities as well. And then the public health context is very important. For us at AMA, also kind of driving and moving more upstream, and what's going to be really helpful for us is last year, we passed policies to really talk very explicitly about anti-racism. And really, thanks to the young students, the med students and the young physicians, they have an analysis that's more likely to be aligned with doing this type of work. But we did get 3 policies passed that have been pretty instrumental for us doing this work around racism as a public health threat, reading our healthcare system of racial essentialism, and then supporting the elimination of race as a proxy for ancestry, genetics, biology, et cetera. And that's not saying to eliminate the use of race. It's still a social construct, and we still need to understand the data and how things play out along the lines of race and ethnicity. But it's to say we can't use it as we should not be using it as a proxy for other biologically based disease. So we've been doing much advocacy as well during this time of COVID. I'm not going to read this long list, but this is just to say, as a healthcare institution specifically, you know, we've focused lots on the healthcare system, but really have been shifting more so to the left-hand side of this diagram to really do more root cause advocacy and public health advocacy. We've launched a medical justice and advocacy fellowship also to train physicians to know more about what does it mean to be an advocate for racial and health justice. That's one of the, I hear physicians say, you know, how do I start doing this? You know, I don't, and some physicians don't even have the analysis yet to build, but we just launched our first class in our cohort. So we're very excited about this. And it's a partnership with the Satra Health Leadership Institute, which is former Surgeon General David Satcher's organization. And we've been doing other engagement around LGBTQ fellowship. And again, training physicians up to equip them with the tools and the resources and the connections. I think that's the other part, is that they now get to be in community with other physicians across the country. And we launched just recently a health equity education center. This is really open to many folks. There are many resources on there that folks can get continuing medical education or other kinds of continuing education credits to learn more about the basics and principles of equity. One of the areas which that is kind of newer to me coming into the healthcare space, that, you know, innovation along technology is highly valued within healthcare, but oftentimes we know is extremely exclusive, predominantly white men led and values who are ideas who are valued. And so this, it really came to attention pretty quickly. So we decided we needed to really have a strong focus on how do we ensure equitable opportunities and structures within this space of tech and innovation, and have been working a lot. So it helped support us and help us be accountable to this space is that we actually launched an external advisory group to help support our own evolution as AMA. And these are leaders from across the country. I'm always tremendously excited when we're engaged with them to help push this forward. And then lastly, I'll just talk about and mention our fostering pathways for truth, reconciliation, and healing. And don't believe that we can really move forward the work of anti-racism unless we really do an assessment of our own institutions, histories, and present practices. And in the strategic plan, there's actually a list of some of the harms that we've identified that AMA, based on some of the decisions that we've made. And it's only the beginning of a list, but the important thing is that we're working and driving to be transparent around that. So in this work, it's really, you know, we're going to do lots around narrative again of what has been invisible, but also working to quantify and qualify the effects of our policies, having a sense of what the true costs have been, and hopefully going on pathways of repair and healing for those harms. I think this is the front line of equity work at this moment in time. We as a country are very behind in doing this type of work, but I feel we really need to start. And health, why not start in the health space overall? Just an example of some of this, the movements we had. We did have an apology in 2008 to the National Medical Association for the exclusion of Black physicians and all the harm that that caused. More recently, Dr. Madera, who's our CEO, was reading some papers that were published a little while back. And in those papers, as he read them, he realized the really kind of explicit and very intentional role Davis played in excluding Black physicians and women. And so made the choice on his own to remove his bust from our public view at AMA headquarters. And also the board voted to remove Nathan Davis's name from an award. So those aren't easy decisions, you know, for an institution. He's the father of AMA, the founding editor of JAMA. But I think as he's doing his work as a leader, and we're doing this work collectively as an institution, he's recognizing the harm that it causes. When people know the history and they walk on the floor every single day, you know, it's not a good feeling. And so, you know, but that can't happen without an individual doing their own work and listening. And then the other part of that we're really working on in terms of truth, reconciliation, and healing is the Flexner Report of 1910. AMA commissioned this report with the support of the Carnegie Foundation. And while the reports, the way the narrative typically goes is to create greater rigor within med schools, it also did a couple of things, but it actually had recommendations in it to close down 5 of the 7 Black med schools at that time. So that has had impact to this day on the ability for physicians, has impact on the lack of diversity within our medical schools to this day. The other kind of decision that I mentioned before, because Black physicians were excluded from the societies, back then, societies were very much connected to your ability to get privileges at hospitals. So if AMA is not allowing you to get into a society, you're not able to get into a hospital. You're also now being excluded from med schools. Where does that leave, you know, Black communities? And so we have to recognize the impacts of those decisions. So this past June, our House of Delegates passed this policy here that we are going to now formally look into, again, the harms of the Flexner report. And I think just in closing out, as we all move forward to this work, I think rightfully so, data is absolutely critical. How well our data systems, how well we can share data, protect data, all very important. But we have to also remember that there's a story behind those data. There's values behind the data. And that, you know, these are people in people's lives. And to really never forget that context to the work that we are doing, because there is a tendency, and I've seen this over the last 2 years, especially, to intellectualize all of this so much to the point where there's no connection to humanness and to the hearts and the souls of people. And that to me is why we're doing this. More so than just the data itself. We're working to protect people so that they can live joyful lives like everyone else. Thank you.